Telling the story of war is a bit like fighting one. You come at it from as many angles as you can. We've been at it since NOW launched over 8 years ago. In fact, the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq have run longer than our involvement in World War II. The compendium we've prepared here puts the focus on our military men and women and the families who support them. Airing these stories of heartbreak and hope right now has a special relevance. NOW's last broadcast is next week. This piece is produced by Brian Epstein.
Our program had its first broadcast in the aftermath of that clear morning in September of 2001, a day in which almost 3,000 people lost their lives in the worst act of terrorism on American soil. Since then, our country has taken on two wars and a global battle against a terrorist enemy that's been tough to pin down.
Machine guns will be at that corner over there.
NOW on PBS has been covering this from the beginning. While countless news outlets have reported on these wars, we've tried to tell stories you may not have heard elsewhere. Stories of the brave military men and women fighting these battles, but also of the families expected to make sacrifices of their own. We also talked to insiders who blew the whistle on faulty intelligence, and we listened to voices of dissent and support during the march to war. We covered the stories of our warriors returning home, with the wounded often finding a military ill-equipped to support their recovery. And we're going to check up on some of those folks now. 9/11 was a call to action for many to fight those who attacked us. But as Bill Moyers reported on this program in January of 2002, amid the patriotic cheering, an occasional voice was heard challenging the gathering official view. One of those was Amber Amundsen.
Amber's husband, Army Specialist Craig Amundsen, was among those killed in the Pentagon.
My dad came to our house within less than 24 hours of the attacks. Of course, after hugging me and comforting me and spending time together, the first dialogue we had was him saying, "We're going to get the people who did this, that are responsible for the deaths of Craig. We will get them. I promise you, honey, it's going to happen."
My only regret when they get that SOB is that I'm not the guy that pulled the trigger. I could rip his heart out and shove it down his throat. That's how I feel.
There was part of my heart that just sank, because I knew then that the way people were going to try to provide comfort to me and other family members in the country might possibly be in a way that meant more death.
Last fall, as the nation went to war in Afghanistan, Amber spoke out. In the Chicago Tribune, she wrote, "I take no comfort in your words of rage." She said that if America went ahead with a military campaign, "You may not do so in the name of justice for my husband. Craig would not have wanted a violent response to avenge his death. We cannot solve violence with violence."
But the war in Afghanistan did go on. And while U.S. forces were searching for the elusive Osama bin Laden, the Bush administration's gaze had already begun to shift west to Baghdad. In the months leading up to the invasion of Iraq, the administration's argument for going to war was clear.
Saddam Hussein has gone to elaborate lengths, spent enormous sums, taken great risks to build and keep weapons of mass destruction.
But the stark reality is no weapons of mass destruction were ever found. We spoke with whistleblowers who broke from the ranks to tell the truth about the faulty intelligence. One of those voices was that of Greg Thielman, a career Foreign Service officer since 1977.
I would certainly acknowledge that the departure of Saddam is something to feel very good about. That, to me, is not the issue. To me, the issue is speaking truthfully to the American people, and I'm not sure that I'm willing to accept the notion, or I'm not that cynical to say that in order to get the citizens of democracy to defend themselves, you have to distort the information provided to them in order for them to do what needs to be done. I don't think that's a justified point of view.
While the debate over whether or not America's reasons for going to war were justified raged on in Congress and in editorial pages across the country, the fact remained that we were asking a lot of our soldiers and their families. And the Army's 3rd Infantry Division has been on the front lines of the war since the beginning. In 2003, it led the ground battle into Baghdad. The unit returned to Iraq again in 2005. In January of 2007, the 3rd ID were bound for Iraq yet again, making it the first division to ever return for a third tour of duty. One of them is Sergeant Mike Obert. He's leaving behind a wife and 4 kids. In the past 5 years, Obert has been in Iraq more than at home.
When he left the first time, I thought, maybe once. Okay, well, maybe twice. But never thought he'd be gone this much.
You get used to being deployed, yes. I don't think you get used to leaving.
Captain Josh Stevenson had to leave 7 days after the birth of his daughter.
I think I worry about how we're going to make sure that she knows her father.
If I got to tell her one thing, it's that it's probably that Daddy loves her very much.
We're going to bring everybody back home. That's the goal. Everybody leaves, everybody comes back together.
It's May 2007. We meet up with the 1st Brigade Combat Team in Ramadi, capital of the Anbar province, one of Iraq's most dangerous regions. One of those helping to secure the Ramadi region is Staff Sergeant Victor Haven, a soldier for 16 years. On his 3rd tour in Iraq, Haven, a master gunner, has taken on the role of platoon sergeant.
3rd tour is harder because it is the 3rd tour. It's harder all around.
And living conditions are Spartan. The only way to contact home is to travel to the base in Ramadi. That means Haven only gets to talk to his wife, Tasha, once a week at most. They've been married 7 years, and he's been away for 5 of them.
The lack of communication is always kind of a hardship you have to go through. She understands it, though. She's an Army wife.
If I'm stressed that Vic hasn't called me or emailed me in days, I mean, either way I go, I'm going to pray. And I'm going to know, I mean, in the back of my brain, I know that he's okay. But at the same time, I put it to the front, like, what if he's not? What if he's not?
She would worry more if I told her how close I really came today to being shot or having something blow up on me or what have you.
He does have cuts too.
Remember Mike Obert, the guy with 4 kids? He's a tank mechanic stationed with roughly 100 other soldiers at a combat outpost in the northwest desert of Anbar. It's the type of place where soldiers talk about other places they'd rather be.
I'd love some snow right now. That's why I want to deploy to Afghanistan. At least it snows there.
To communicate home, there are 3 computers, but the soldiers tell us one is often broken. This morning, Mike is talking to his wife, Jewel, via webcam.
My husband spent more time in Iraq for the past few years than he has here. He actually says he comes home to visit.
So what do all these years of separation mean for Mike and Jewel's marriage?
Ours is doing okay. We fight a lot, but we're making it. I mean, 10-year anniversary is in December, so that's something.
Back at Fort Stewart, it's summertime, 6 months since the soldiers took off. Babies have become toddlers. Birthdays, anniversaries, holidays come and go. Baby Reagan, named for the former president, was only 7 days old when Josh got on the plane to Iraq. She's now nearly 6 months, and Misty has been swept up by single mom life.
Don't cry, okay?
By the time he comes home, and she'll be a toddler and not a baby, and I think that's difficult for me to think about, that he will have missed her entire babyhood.
While the troop surge in Iraq was producing dividends, there was the other war in Afghanistan, which at the time was largely treated as a success story in the media and by the White House when it was being noticed at all. There were, at its peak, about 170,000 U.S. troops in Iraq. But in the summer of 2008, when producer Bill Gentile traveled to Afghanistan for this program, there were just 34,000 American troops there. And as our report showed, violence and instability were on the rise.
For nearly 3 weeks, I followed the Marines on the front lines of what has been called the real war on terror. Their goal, to push the Taliban back and destroy its fixed positions, and just as important, to win the support of the villagers and get the economy restarted. We make our way past fields of poppies and immediately take enemy fire.
Is that incoming, sir?
Yes, it is. That's incoming.
The Marines respond with artillery and with the sniper rifle. The Marines spot insurgents moving in on their position from this compound. Miller requests air and artillery support.
Black Knight 6, this is Apache 2.
Rockets from the helicopters set the fields ablaze.
What do you think?
I think they're dead.
But what comes next is just as tough. The Marines need to win the trust of the locals, who have been living in a battle zone for years. Still warriors, the Marines now are diplomats. Saeed Gould, a farmer, tells the Marines his home has been damaged by American bombs and artillery.
I apologize for my Marines.
Saeed urges the Marines to come to his home and see the damage and asks them to pay for it. During the last days of my visit, Captain Dinan took me to Saeed Gould's compound.
Assalamu alaikum.
I understand that there was some damage to your compound.
About a month after this encounter, I got word that the Marines had paid Saeed Gould half the money he wanted to repair his home, and the rest was on its way.
A friend of mine went out recently to talk to a group of officers at Fort Leavenworth in Kansas. And during the course of his presentation, he said, the United States is at war. And at that point, one of the officers cut him off and said, "No, sir." He said, "The United States Army is at war. The United States of America is at the mall."
While 9/11 may have changed America's collective sense of security and insecurity, not all Americans share the burden of going to war. That's left up to the soldiers on the front lines and the families they leave behind.
We will be a fleeting moment on a television screen to them, and you know, maybe they'll feel a bit sorry, or maybe they'll feel a bit proud, or whatever, but the bottom line is we, unfortunately, don't affect their day-to-day life. Our country may be technically at war, but to the average citizen, life is no different.
But for some families, life will never be the same. Every military family awaits the letters and phone calls, but dreads the knock at the door.
And I could tell it was a chaplain. And I just screamed, "Just tell me, is he gone? I just need to know, is he gone?"
Sergeant First Class William Zaffe died June 19th at the age of 35. A roadside bomb took his life.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
It's 10 days after Sergeant Zaffe's death. His wife, Kenitha, and their children, 9-year-old Anastasia, 5-year-old Cameron, and 3-year-old Spencer, have driven from Fort Stewart, Georgia, to the Cincinnati airport to welcome William Zaffe home for one last time. Anastasia says it hasn't really sunk in for her brothers.
My brother, Spencer, he's a little too little to understand. When we say Daddy's gone, he thinks we mean, you know, Dad's over in Iraq still.
And Cameron, she says, can't process it all.
And he wrote a letter saying, "Dad, come back to life. Please, Mom really misses you."
Everyone's silent as the plane doors open.
Like one last hug to Daddy. At peace, boo. We just gotta be strong and go on. This is not how we wanted it, but this is how some end up.
William Zaffe, a soldier for 16 years, deployed once, twice, three times to Iraq for his country. If it's possible to make the news of the loss of a loved one even tougher to bear, there's this. A Now investigation by senior correspondent Maria Hinojosa found that the military has not always been forthright about the circumstances surrounding the death of a soldier.
Maybe some others could say, well, it doesn't matter how he died. Well, it does. It's important. It's a part of history. It's a part of my son's life, how he died. And they're not going to take that away from him.
Peggy Booty wants the truth. Her son, Private Jesse Booty, was killed in Iraq on May 5, 2004. Peggy was first told her son died when a truck hit his Humvee. Only later did she find out it wasn't true.
I finally get a copy of the autopsy. In the autopsy said, Specialist Jesse Booty died as a result of friendly fire. I like to think they think it hurts too bad to tell a family that their son was killed by friendly fire, but that's not the truth. What hurts is not knowing.
And for the troops that did come home, their struggles often did not end after leaving the battlefield. Too many soldiers are returning with post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. A Now investigation found that instead of providing these soldiers with the help they needed, the Army was too often discharging people for misconduct. Some veterans' advocates called this an expedient way of getting rid of soldiers returning from war with psychological problems, like Jonathan Norrell.
One of the most traumatic experiences for me in Iraq was when a man was shot in the head, and his wife and his daughter begged me to help him and were crying and upset. And there was absolutely nothing I could do for him. He'd been shot in the face 7 or 8 times.
Norrell learned to deal with those traumatic experiences by not thinking about them. After 9.5 months in Iraq, he was sent back to Texas, given 6 days leave to visit family. And that's when the war suddenly caught up with him.
I was driving back to my grandma's house, and the lights, I don't know what it was. I forgot where I was. I couldn't see the road anymore. I completely lost it, crying. I couldn't breathe. I was scared.
That first panic attack was just the beginning of a downward spiral. Even though he was now back at Fort Hood, Norrell was plagued by disturbing memories of war. He didn't know who to turn to for help. He started to self-destruct by self-medicating.
I started drinking all the time. It got to where
Norrell finally went to see a doctor who diagnosed him with PTSD. The doctor recommended to Norrell's commanders that he be medically discharged immediately and sent home. But that never happened. By then, Norrell had racked up a long list of misconduct charges. He says he just wanted out. So when his commanders told him they were going to discharge him for misconduct, and that as a result, he would lose all his benefits, Norrell signed the papers anyway.
I definitely signed it because I wanted to go home. I don't care about money. I don't care about anything anymore except going home.
But with the help of advocates like Carissa Picard of Military Spouses for Change, Norrell's bad conduct discharge was overturned.
In a sense, I think she saved my life because she came in and within 12 hours I was getting help.
There are enduring psychological effects of war, and there are the enduring physical wounds. A staggering 19% of all soldiers returning home from the battlefield today have traumatic brain injuries. Major advances in battlefield medicine have kept alive service members who might not have survived previous wars. And in many of these cases, it's often left to spouses and parents to provide extended care that's needed.
Good job. Head up, shoulders back.
Now on PBS, spent time with Private Eric Edmondson, a soldier who was hit by an improvised explosive device while on patrol in Iraq. It left him with a traumatic brain injury. Eric came back to a military hospital system that wasn't prepared for the influx of soldiers with these kinds of injuries. Eric's parents realized they would need to step in. He was at a VA facility in Richmond, Virginia, 3 months before his dad decided he needed to act. The final straw for his father was when he found Eric in a hallway at the VA facility, getting what was being called therapy.
they call it hallway therapy there. It's good for him to be watching things going on and that stuff. But Eric was slumped over in his chair, drooling. Call it what you will, but it wasn't therapy.
So Ed and his wife Beth made the decision to take their son home to New Bern, North Carolina. To give Eric the help he needs, the family has made some major sacrifices. Eric requires 24-hour care, so Ed gave up his job as a supervisor at ConAgra and lost not only his income, but also his health insurance. The VA covers outpatient care for Eric, including speech and physical therapy twice a week, but isn't paying for the 24-hour care he now gets from his family.
We're going to walk over to the chair. Here we
go. For families like the Edmondsons, who take on the task of caring for a loved one 24 hours a day, they're largely on their own. Without any income coming in, they were forced to sell their house and are now living on Eric's disability payments.
There shouldn't have to be, you know, dads, mothers, wives, husbands, you know, sisters, brothers, giving up their life as they knew it in order to care for an injured soldier.
Legislation now pending in Congress would help caregivers like Ed by getting them financial assistance, health care, and medical training. Advocates hope the legislation will pass soon, but families of the wounded are still waiting. It's now been 8.5 years of fighting, first in Afghanistan, then Iraq and Afghanistan, through much of 2 terms for George W. Bush and now Barack Obama, with no hard end in sight. We recently checked in with the Army's 3rd Infantry Division. The last time we'd seen them, they were on their 3rd tour in Iraq, fighting to secure the Anbar province. This past winter, they were poised to deploy yet again.
Four times. If you told me at the onset of this, like OF1 said, you know what, you're going to go back like 4 or 5 times, I'd have said, no, that would have been total denial of that. Couldn't see that coming.
Staff Sergeant Victor Haven's wife, Tasha, is, well, not pleased.
This is the 4th time that he's going to be gone. 4, I've been married for 10 years in April, so you do the math. Almost half of my marriage, he's been gone.
As for Jonathan Norell, the medic who came home from Iraq with post-traumatic stress disorder, it's his view that enough is enough.
I think we could use a break. I don't think we're going to do any better over there. I think we're just going to make more enemies and have more casualties. Be more body bags coming home now.
These days, Norell is using his GI benefits for college near his hometown in Illinois, where he helps other veterans adjust to civilian life on campus. He's still in therapy for his PTSD, and he feels he's making progress. But he explains that every day is a struggle.
You carry around this heavy burden, this duffel bag full of bad memories that you have to share, or it'll consume you. It's like poison. And I'm just kind of take it one day at a time, try to live life for now, and be as happy as possible.
So we've been watching selections, and pretty intense selections at that, from our war coverage. You can see the full shows by going to pbs.org/now. Connect to Now online at pbs.org/now. Check out full, free, and uninterrupted versions of all our journalistic coverage of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. Just go to our homepage and click on the button marked The Way We War. Connect to Now at pbs.org/now. And that's it for now. From New York, I'm David Brancaccio. We'll see you next week.